port switch, mm-hmm. and you just test if it's working, if the counter's going down.
You don't have to use CSP if you don't want to. I could listen, but
I mean, it's really just a matter of, like, if you hear yourself, then you know whether or not mm-hmm. it's coming out.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever want to pause it, then use that red pause and then stop on top.
Okay.
So I think it's... Yeah,
and you'll be here in case we run into some unexpected...
Oh, difference. Definitely. I'll be here. If anything technical happens, I can call up Matt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good deal.
All right.
So it's ready to go now.
Yes, it's looks like it's counting down now. So if you want to pause it, you can pause it.
No, that's okay. I think we're ready to go. So... I understand, but... It says record here. I assume it's on, but I'm not talking. Remember, Pete, do you put this?
Yeah. You want me to test this?
Yeah, let's test it.
I think I can hear it, yeah.
Okay.
I can hear it.
Okay, well, then I guess we're ready to go.
Okay.
Okay. This is Peter Iverson. I'm speaking with Peterson Zah on several topics today. This is what day is it? I can't remember. In roughly mid-October 2008. And Dr. Zah, one of the things we wanted to talk about in a little more detail was the issue of the disagreements and conflicts with the Hopi Nation, and recognizing that it's more a complicated story than most people realize, but you come from that part of Navajo country, and be glad to hear more about your perceptions about how this evolved and the difficulties that the two nations found in trying to resolve or at least be able to continue with things.
Okay. Maybe prior to that,
sure.
I can talk a little about the earth, sky, and people.
Yes, that'd be fine if you're ready to do that. Sure.
Yeah.
That'd
and
be
then,
great.
Then
that'd
I'll
be great.
Get into
okay,
the
now that's the right order. Sure.
Okay.
Okay.
Earth, sky, and people. One of the things that the Navajo people, traditional people, really believe in is that we are individuals that respect the earth, and you always have to be thankful for what the earth has to offer to people. And in our situation, living back in Low Mountain, that there was no difference between what the other traditional Navajo people had taught the young ones and their sibling. And that is that one thing that the earth has to offer is food to ourselves, to our animals, and all the living things out there that the earth provides. And therefore, you have to respect the Mother Earth, and that means that when it rains, particularly during the female rain season, you have to sit down, you have to pay attention to what the Great Spirit is trying to tell us. And by these natural forces such as rain and snow, the Great Spirit is talking to us through some of those kinds of events and some of those movements that happen only by the force of the Great Spirit. And so early on you learn that. And in my situation, that was something that I was taught, you know, by my grandparents. And that is respect for all of the living things. And it's something that one individual living out there has to really, really appreciate. And I guess because of those kinds of teaching, I carry that on later on in life where, you know, I respected everybody. I respected things. I respected women population, what they brought. And I guess because of those kinds of feeling, I worked very closely with Annie Wanika, and I made her as my advisor because she was able to bring on different perspective into my administration. and something that you hardly ever hear other people say. She would be one of those individuals that gave those love and advice. And I know that when she's talking to you, she has this motherly instinct when she talks to people. And you can't help but just listen to her. And maybe it's because of those kinds of early on things that I learned that I was able to respect people like her. And it's something that I think every individual, whether they're Navajo or not, they have to practice is the respect that they have for the living things out there, including the earth, because the earth is alive, and it's something that the Great Spirit, only the Great Spirit, can do. And then you have certain beliefs. Everybody has certain belief. Mine was the Navajo traditional belief. And people go to church, they have their own religious belief. And with me, I didn't really pay all that much attention to all of the other religion because I knew I was a Diné. And I was brought up to believe that concept that there is a Great Spirit watching over each and every one of us. And that was the Navajo teachings that I got from my grandparents and from my parents. And as a result, I end up believing the traditional Navajo religious belief. And I practiced that throughout my life. I may not go to every ceremony and participate intimately during those ceremonies, but my beliefs were there. It was just unfortunate that I can't go to, you know, every religious events that happen in your community and even with your friends and your relatives. But my belief was there. The spirit is there, and to this day, I still do that. And it's something that I learned how to appreciate early on in life also. And it's something that I think every Navajo individual need to pay attention to because nowadays there's so many people out there, groups of people that are trying to entice the young Navajo to go their way, and they're always trying to recruit them into their own religion. And we as a Navajo people, we have to weigh each one and try to say to ourselves which one fits me and which one is something that I will end up really, really believing. But you only decide that after you do your own research and after you ask a lot of questions like the way we should, and then you make those decisions, and that's how you decide. And so it's something that I believe the Navajo people are so fortunate in having is those kinds of belief where you believe in the living things, you believe in everything that's alive, animals, and the sky, the whole system of universe that's out there that only the Great Spirit can make. And that's why on occasion when I'm passing one of the four holy mountains, like the San Francisco Peaks, or you go over to Durango, Colorado, the Bensa, Mount Hesperus, you stop for a minute and you give a blessing to living things out there, because what it does is that it brings to you a certain beauty that man cannot do. For me, when I see the beauty of San Francisco Peaks and the beauty of one of the four holy mountains, I always think to myself, now we can't do that. we can't make something like that. We as mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. man can't do it. Only the Great Spirit, and through the Great Spirit's mind and hands, the Great Spirit and the deities that lived back then were the only ones that can do that. They were empowered by God to do that, and they put these things and they left these things behind mm-hmm. so that we can see that and retain our ecstatic values, our sense of beauty. Mm-hmm. Because in today's world, sometimes we live so fast and there are so many things that are happening, many, many negative things that mm-hmm. are happening. You can't turn on a television each day and expect to hear some good news.
Yeah.
And so when you come by either one of those four holy mountains, a beautiful lake, you have to stop and you have to pay attention. You have to pay respect to mm-hmm. those places that the Great Spirit has put those things before man's eyes. And I always appreciate it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily do the Navajo people pray to the mountain, mm-hmm. but they pray through the mountain mm-hmm. to get mm-hmm. to the Great mm-hmm. Spirit. And I mm-hmm. think there's a distinction between the two.
Right.
And so basically that's my belief. And it's something that sometimes the general public won't really understand.
Mm-hmm.
But when you try to explain those using the English language,
mm-hmm.
you lose a lot of taste.
Yes.
You lose a lot of meaning, and only one can explain the full meaning of what it means in the Navajo language. And so Navajo people are blessed with mm-hmm. also that kind of such a picturesque language that we have to describe whatever it mm-hmm. is that we feel
mm-hmm.
and see from day to day.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to say that. Good. About the earth and the people.
Thank you.
Going into our relationship with our neighbor, the Hopi Nation, that is one of the most complicated issue. And the way I look at it is that going all the way back hundreds of years ago, when the state became a state here, when Arizona became a state here in Arizona,
mm-hmm.
and then when all these other states were created, and then when the United States government came into being here in North America, much of what we face with the Hopi Nation was something that was created by the federal government. And so it was basically something that the federal government decided that they should resolve these issues certain ways. And when they say that, I always look at the other side of the coin,
mm-hmm.
Which is that that it's something that we didn't really create, but it was created for us by the federal government. And it was unfortunate that many of our people didn't really think of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they just had us fighting each other for years and years. Mm-hmm. And when you really study the topic, it was something that the federal government did. And so basically, the Navajo Hopi land dispute is very complicated in that sense. And it was also something that has been everlasting, it seems like, because it went through just so many generations mm-hmm. of Navajo people. It went through so many leadership on both sides, Navajo mm-hmm. Hopi. But I had one thing that I believe in when I went into the chairmanship in 1983, and that is the concept that the Hopi people aren't going anywhere.
Right.
The Navajo people aren't going anywhere either.
Right.
So we might as well get along with one another and begin getting acquainted with each other. irregardless of what the land dispute may bring to the people, that we have to coexist and we have to live side by side in a peaceful way. That was my philosophy going into my chairmanship, my first term, and that I was to make every effort to befriend the Hopi Nation, and only through friendship, and only through, you know, something like what we were made of, understanding what we were made of, a traditional way on both sides, can we bring about understanding and love for each other between our people? Because regardless of what we thought about one another at the time, our younger generation, the Hopi young people and the Navajo young people, they were all intermarrying. Many of them were intermarrying with each other. So that meant that we as leaders, we had to look at those kinds of statistics mm-hmm. among the young people. So therefore, our job is to make the young people and the older people understand that we have that that's coming into both sides of the family. So we had to accept that. And because of that, I was very, very fortunate to be in office mm-hmm. for the Navajo Nation as its chairman at the same time that Ivan Sidney
right.
was also the chairman of the Hopi Nation. Ivan and I went to school together at Phoenix Indian School way back in the 1950s, in the mid-1950s. And we knew each other back then. And he was just a little youngster that always befriended the Navajo people, and he was just that kind of a person, very pleasant individual, and there wasn't any kind of hatefulness inside of him. He was just a kind person, and so when you know somebody that way, you don't want to begin working with him in such a way that you try to create any kind of hostility between you and that particular person. And so I looked at Ivan that way because I saw a lot of goodness in what could happen because of our position, him being the Hopi leader, elected leader, and my being the Navajo Hopi elected leader. And I thought that this was a perfect opportunity to bring the two tribes back together. But one of the most difficult time during that period, when I got elected in 1982 and 83, when I took office in 1983,
right.
It was very, very difficult for both of us, because on both sides of the issue, our people were not really accepting what we were trying to do, putting the two tribes together, because in the past they got polarized politically on the issue of the land ownership. And it was almost impossible to immediately put the two tribes back together. But we knew that in the long run, if we can give it a try, and if we can begin to put people back on the right track of a friendly coexistence, that in the long run it's going to work out. And people are going to cooperate, and people are going to work together for one common good of both both tribes, individuals from both tribes. We knew that, and so, but it was a big, heavy political risk on both sides for us to do that. But my friend Ivan Sidney was one of these individuals that was tenacious, and he just had the right attitude. He had a lot of courage to do what he did. And I was just extremely lucky to become the chairman of the Navajo Nation at the same time. He was the chairman of the Hopi Nation. And as a result of our two positions, we then began the long, long road to the healing process. Mm-hmm. And to this day, something like 30 years pass, and we still have a lot of work to do to have a complete cooperation among all of the people that live on the Hopi as well as on the Navajo side. But what really makes me happy is to see the progress that's taking place, to see how the two tribes are beginning to work together with the new generations of Navajo and Hopi people coming in to enter into these different agreements that they now have, where they recognize each other as a sovereign nation, and that there are some problems that exist between the two, but they agree to disagree when there is a disagreement, but doing it in a friendly way, doing it with integrity, doing it with a lot of respect. That's different than the way the Navajo Nation and the Hopi Nation were going after each other way back in the early 1970s and even further back into 1960. And so we kind of changed the whole complexion of the Navajo-Hopi land dispute. And here I am 30 years later. I'm just glad that we did what we did, and because it just had to be done. There was just too many resources being spent from both sides to fight one another, that it was better to come together and where we have to disagree with respect and dignity. And but knowing that in the long run, the goal is to have the two tribes come together and become friends like they have been in the past, and begin making some progress that they really, really need to make. In other words, and I'll give you two examples.
Okay.
One of them is the uranium tailing had to be dealt with in Tuba City area called Rare Metals, east of Tuba City. Well, that uranium tailing, when the wind came in early spring, it blew the uranium tailing everywhere, on Navajo land as well as on Hopi land. And it landed on our animals, and it landed on the grass, and it landed on people. And the uranium tailing and the particles that it was blowing did not discriminate between Navajo and Hopi. It landed where it may. And as a result, the doctors at Indian Health Service were having to take care of many, many patients that were getting cancer to their bodies. And no one really knows how much of that came from the uranium tail and dust that was blown all over the place. So Ivan Sidney and I had to agree from the Navajo and from the Hopi side to cooperate and bring the federal government out there so that they can begin the process of remediating the uranium tailing. And as a result, within something like 3 or 4 years, they were able to pay for the costs of remediation and covering the uranium tailing so that it's not dangerous. And they had to make it so that it's safe for 1,000 years.
Oh,
and that could only be done if you have a commitment from both tribes, because mm-hmm. the land where the tailing was right in the midst of where Navajo Hopi line was. And so we need a permission from the Hopi, and the Hopi needed a permission from the Navajo to make that into an agreed upon resolution to the federal government. And that was the only way that the federal government could fund the project, mm-hmm. if the both tribes can agree. So I'm very proud to say that Ivan Chairman Sidney pushed that from his end, mm-hmm. and I pushed that from my end. And as a result, we had the agreement to correct that mm-hmm. situation. That's only one good example mm-hmm. of what cooperation can mm-hmm. bring, the kind of progress that we were looking for to mm-hmm. both tribes. The second example is the roads, all-weather roads uh-huh. in dire need out there.
Yes.
Many of our tribal members, they have to drive pickup trucks through sand and gravel and through yeah. mud.
Yeah.
And because we don't enjoy all kinds of miles and miles of all-weather road. So we created what we call a turquoise trail
mm-hmm.
that would go from and begin from the Hopi Nation's land and then go into Navajo, and that would be a federally funded program.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there are in some areas on the Navajo and Hopi where those kinds of roads were really, really needed, particularly yeah. in the winter time.
Yeah.
And when it snows and rain, we need that all-weather road in between those two, between the various communities mm-hmm. out there. And so it was only through intertribal agreement between the two tribes we were able to push that. And the late Senator Barry Goldwater really, really pushed that through Congress to get it appropriated. Uh-huh. So that's only a second example uh-huh. of the kind of progress that one could have through cooperation. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. when we left office, our other people, the leaders after us, really did not pick up the slack, and so
right.
it never really, really got finished to our satisfaction. Mm-hmm. But those are only two good examples.
Uh-huh.
Of what could happen. And I think the school
mm-hmm.
is another good example, Hopi High School.
Right.
You know, they needed Navajo support to build those facilities. And Ivan Sidney and I worked together to do that, because we have children
mm-hmm.
from the Navajo side as well as children from the Hopi side that need education.
Right.
They were shutting down the boarding schools right. here in Phoenix and in California and Oklahoma and right. Nevada.
Right.
So we needed a local school
yep.
where Navajo and Hopi kids can go. And as a result, the creation of the Hopi High School by the federal government. And that was only possible through cooperation between the two tribes. Mm-hmm. And so besides these three examples, you could go into any other subject. You need those kinds of cooperation
mm-hmm.
for the tribes to make any kind of meaningful progress
mm-hmm.
that will benefit the young generation mm-hmm. of the Navajo and Hopi people. And the land dispute is a very complicated issue,
yes.
and it's been going on for over 100 years, yeah. so it was not easy to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very fortunate to have leadership from the Hopi Nation that was able to buy into some of the things that we were both promoting. So I can't say that.
Sure.
I'm completely responsible for that. It's something that the Hopi Nation and its leaders also had to push, as well as other people that I was working with. And it's an issue that you know, many of the people dealt with, which always didn't come out right.
Right.
They met well, but it just didn't come out to the satisfaction of the local people, and so I was just very fortunate in having so many understanding people from both sides to deal with that issue.
You know, I've heard this argued in two different ways. One is that because you had the people out there, many of the people out there were among the more traditional and more separate in some ways, people that relocation became particularly difficult for them because you could never obviously provide an exactly identical kind of environment. And if you moved into Pinon, then some of the people in Pinon had mixed emotions about it, and if you added new land, then all the rest. So, but I've heard it argued also that because a decreasing percentage of Navajos lived the sort of traditional subsistence, you know, grazing animals and so forth and so on, that because that percentage was declining, in some ways the disputes over grazing and so forth and so on were reduced because a smaller percentage of people were involved, you know, culturally, economically, and socially, sort of in the old way. But I've also heard it argued, on the other hand, that because there was this decline, that it made the people who wanted to continue with it, and many of them were elderly, it made it all the more difficult for them to get to continue with certain things that they thought was important. And so they were particularly unhappy about, because they'd already been sort of put in a marginal situation. You see what I mean? I mean, they sort of argue, you hear people argue it kind of in both directions.
Well, I think there were some traditional people and the lifestyle that they led for many, many years. There was a decline in that group of people, decline in population, and which played into some of what was happening. And I would agree that yes, that probably did happen, but it also reduce the number of Navajo traditional people that would continue that lifestyle.
Exactly.
And they didn't really have any choice to except to seek some other alternative, and which was to move in with their children. In some cases, those children were removed already from the Navajo and Hopi land. And so it's something that made the relocation program very complicated, and it was such an emotional issue for many, many families. And for the federal government thought that all we had to do was make some houses available for Navajo people who may want to move off the Navajo reservation into these urban areas, and then move into nearby cities and towns, and that's all we had to do to resolve the issue.
Yeah.
But it didn't work out that way because the Navajo people live a certain lifestyle all their life, and which was, you know, the dependency on land and animals and grazing and all of that. And when you uproot people from those kinds of situations all of a sudden in 1 year, for example, and put them into an urban setting where they have to pay taxes, for example, and on their homes, and when they have to do all these other things that they weren't accustomed to, then it becomes a difficult issue.
Yeah.
And it's very, very extremely difficult for those particular family to live that kind of a lifestyle and begin changing all of a sudden within a matter of six months to a year to completely change, you know, their attitude, their lifestyle, to the lifestyle of the urban people. It was almost unacceptable to many of the Navajo people who move, and that's why it became such an emotional issue. And so the relocation program never really succeeded in anywhere that the federal government did. And even going all the way back to the late 1940s and early 1950, the federal program had these massive relocation program. Yeah. And the whole idea was to get the Indian people off their reservation, put them into the urban areas, and let them become gainfully employed, and let them buy homes, and they'll have their children here, and they'll become urbanized, and they'll be just like any of us, you know, tax-paying citizen. And that was the plan.
The border town schools had dormitories, didn't they, also, that people were pushed in that direction?
Dormitories and school were then built in those towns, and but that never really that never really worked out, mainly because the Indian people want to remain what they were meant to be. The Indian people wanted to be for Navajo. They wanted to be a Navajo, and they wanted to live like the Navajo people always live out there, out in open space. And having horses, having cattle, having sheep, and everything, and the freedom to exist out there as they please, and that was a custom, and so I imagine from the Hopi side, they also had a lifestyle, but some of them also had to be relocated. You know, from where they were living before before the partitioning of the land, so they had to move back into their own side of the reservation, the divided land.
It's a much smaller number of people.
It's it's a much smaller number, but the effects were the same.
Yes, that's right.
The emotion and everything were the same. So it never really worked out, the relocation program for the Indian people, whether it's a Navajo Hopi issue or relocating them for jobs and for schools away from the reservation. It just was not a good program.
The Bennett Freeze didn't help things either.
Well, the Bennett Freeze was a special issue, and it's still today, 30, 40 years later, you know, we're still having to deal with that. And that even made the Navajo Hopi land dispute even more complicated on top of what it was before.
Okay. I remembered the other question that was relating to the and you may not want to tackle this right away, but the Native American Church and how it has, it seems to me as an outsider, it has a somewhat different role and place, you know, within Navajo Nation that it once had. It was such an enormously emotional issue for so many years. Raymond Nakai ran for chairman in part on the pledge to, you know, begin to change all of that. But there were a lot of people who did not like this new church coming in, but over time there have been more people who have found it not necessarily as a replacement, but as an additional help in terms of brotherhood, in terms of dealing with some other domestic issues. And today the percentage of, or the number of Navajos who are involved in it in one way or another is, you know, it's different than it once was. It seems like more people have sort of accommodated or made their peace with it or whatever. But it certainly seems to play, you know, a significant role in the lives of many Navajo people.
Well, the Native American church movement, I guess, happened way back sometimes in the late 1930s, 1940s. And the Native American people had their own way of practicing their religious beliefs and what they believe in. And I don't know all of the detail, and I don't pretend to be a historian on that subject, but it's something that the Navajo people felt going into the mid-1950s, mm-hmm. When this movement came to the Navajo Nation. And many of the Navajo people who, by the way, went to school.
Right. That was one of the main conduits.
Yep. Yeah. One that went to school in Oklahoma. They mm-hmm. went to school in other places throughout America. And they became friends in contact with other Indian mm-hmm. tribes that mm-hmm. had that religion. And they intermarried with some of those mm-hmm. other Indian tribal members. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea of Native American church movement then began moving on mm-hmm. to the Navajo Nation. I remember the Navajo Nation government mm-hmm. Fought them.
Yes.
And they even passed a resolution, a tribal council resolution, mm-hmm. Saying that... you know, they don't really belong mm-hmm. On the Navajo Nation. So in many respects, it was a discriminatory mm-hmm. Using religion mm-hmm. For the Navajo Nation to do what they did. But Navajo Nation being a sovereign nation, the courts left that alone.
Yeah.
And the Native American church people were raising the issue of freedom of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
Spelled out in the United States Constitution. And so that battle began way back then.
Mm-hmm.
And there's one individual that really lived through this whole mm-hmm. Fight between the tribal government and the Native American church is David Clark.
Uh-huh.
And David Clark is considered one of the top leadership mm-hmm. in the Native mm-hmm. American
mm-hmm.
church
mm-hmm.
Lives on the Navajo. And to this day,
mm-hmm.
He still makes his home in Tisto, Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Highly respected individual, yes. Very bright individual, and that really... loves the Navajo people. And I have a tremendous amount mm-hmm. of respect for David for mm-hmm. what he believes in mm-hmm. and what he did as an individual mm-hmm. to enhance and to make the church a lot stronger mm-hmm. on the Navajo.
Mm-hmm.
And some people may disagree with Native American church.
Sure.
But it's a religion. It's mm-hmm. a belief.
Mm-hmm.
It's a belief. And they have every right to promote what they were promoting.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that caught my eyes as a young boy was what they were teaching.
Uh-huh.
They were teaching that, for example, drinking is wrong.
Yeah.
They were teaching that you can't do all of these violent things
mm-hmm.
Against one another. That if you have children, you have to take care of your children. And that education was very important.
Mm-hmm.
They taught.
Mm-hmm.
The local people, all of these, for me, mm-hmm. one wonderful things because mm-hmm. I heard them
mm-hmm.
say that.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, I guess early on, I decided that, you know, if they are promoting all of those things,
mm-hmm.
then why
sure.
why are we fighting
yes.
them?
Right.
And it was no different than my also listening to, for example, a church such as the Protestant or
right.
the Catholics
right.
Doing the same thing
mm-hmm.
out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they were teaching some good things.
Mm-hmm.
And so Native American church was a big movement that was pushed by individuals like David Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And there was another person by the name of Hola So,
right, right.
And he was from around Sawmill
right,
area.
Right.
that lived through a lot during that period of time. And he worked very closely with David Clark. David Clark was just a young man.
Yeah.
And David Clark was this individual that got jailed and arrested by tribal police and got jailed. And but he never gave in. Yeah. He just kept on going. And that's why he's such a devoted person to the church, is because of what he went through.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, he's still considered one of the well-known American Indian religious leaders throughout America. And he certainly has my respect for some of the things that he did. He did accomplish a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And some say that probably around half of the Navajo Nation is a member of the Native American Church, and maybe or some would say no, it's really a third.
Mm-hmm.
You have one third of the Navajo people that belong to the Native American Church, one third that still believes in the Navajo tradition, another third that believes in Christianity, and so they're out there. And there are groups to be reckoned with, and you just have to look at those different groups and see what they promote, see what the practitioners do, and what kind of ceremonies they perform, and then what the group is doing as a whole, in order for someone to really get a good handle on what is it that these churches are all about.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know that in any of these three groups, there's always a small minority that would abuse, that would abuse the system, that would abuse whatever the group is trying to do and whatever paraphernalia that they use.
Yes.
To keep the church going, there are the abusers, and maybe it's no different than in America. You know, we have different kinds of food, but sometimes we abuse those food. We abuse alcohol. We abuse other substance, and but it was not meant to be that way. So even in these religious group, you also have, you know, that minority group that's represented, and no one likes to see it. I don't like to see it.
Right.
Sometimes people use those in the wrong way.
Right. When I put together that collection of documents for Navajo people, Diné speeches and letters and petitions, I was very impressed going through the transcript of the council meetings in the 50s about David Clark and people like that. They really give eloquent testimony. And it's also interesting to see letters from young members of the church who've been serving in the armed forces during World War II. And they say, you know, here I am fighting for my country. And at the same time, I'm not being allowed to vote, you know, in off-reservation elections. And we're not able to hold a Native American church meeting without it being disrupted. And so, in a sense, they were calling on America to live up to its ideals and to practice, you know, what it preached. And there really seems to be a strong, you know, sense that it gradually becomes more and more politically effective, that, you know, this doesn't have to supplant or replace other forms of, you know, ceremonial or traditional leadership. It's just an additional one that's being brought in and over time being made, you know, into something that becomes traditional, I think.
Yeah, well, one of the other leaders that kind of, when a tribal government was fighting with Native American church members, a leader came into being, and that was Raymond Nakai.
Yes, exactly.
He was the person that kind of calmed everything down.
Mm-hmm.
And by telling the people and saying, look, we live in America, and in America, and through Constitution, we have freedom of the religion.
Mm-hmm.
And why are we criticizing this one particular group so much? you know, that we're beginning to fight with each other, mm-hmm. and there's so much hatred that is beginning to surface here and there throughout Navajo land. So he calmed them mm-hmm. down, and I always mm-hmm. credit him mm-hmm. For doing that. And mm-hmm. he says in his most of his political speeches that he gives, you know, that I'm not going to, as a chairman, I'm not going to tell you what to believe in.
Right.
You believe in whatever it is that you believe in. That's your right.
Mm-hmm.
And the government is no longer going to be fighting you. You believe in what you believe in.
And he didn't do it for this purpose, but he got tremendous support from some of the areas in the Navajo Nation that were where the church had, you know, a lot of members. And it made a difference in him, you know, gaining the chairmanship.
It sure did. Mm-hmm. And you just have to give credit to people like, you know, the late Chairman Raymond Nakai for mm-hmm. doing what he did. And it was through his effort
mm-hmm.
dealing with the Native American church issue
mm-hmm.
that he introduced into the council for them to approve
mm-hmm.
Navajo Bill of Rights that mm-hmm. essentially says that.
Yes.
And so it was through people like him and David Clark and others mm-hmm. that really work on that issue mm-hmm. So hard to make that a document that we mm-hmm. now have as part of our Navajo Nation preamble
mm-hmm.
in our tribal code.
When Mr. Nakai passed away some time ago, somebody asked me about, you know, his status, his role, and I said, as an outsider, I don't have much to say, but it always seemed to me like he was the first of the modern era chairman. I mean, his use of the radio, his ability to speak, you know, eloquently in both languages, and his determination for the Navajos really to be in charge of their own government and to reduce the kind of power that people like Norman Littell, the attorney, had held, that he was, I thought, historians and others had really not given that sufficient credit, that he was a more significant figure than many, you know, younger people realized. And it seems to me it was difficult because he became chairman when he was a relatively young man, and he served for those two terms, and then MacDonald came in after that, and you came in after that. And he lived a long time, but it was difficult for him to find a proper role or medium or whatever to put those abilities to work, you know, in a constructive and appropriate fashion after he became the chairman. Maybe that's something that many chairmen in many tribes struggle with when you've been, you know, in this position of authority and power and influence, and then what do you do next?
Yeah, I would agree that, you know, Raymond Nakai was one of those individuals that was very much dedicated to helping the mm-hmm. Native American church, helping the church itself grow and where it would be respected by the tribal mm-hmm. government. And he kept the tribal government out of their affairs
mm-hmm.
And then in educating the Navajo public about mm-hmm. what freedom mm-hmm. of the religion mm-hmm. is all about mm-hmm. and what it means. And so he had a giant role.
Yeah.
And he was one of these individuals that used the radio mm-hmm. very, very effectively. Mm-hmm. He was an excellent, excellent speaker of the Navajo language.
Mm-hmm.
He created Navajo words to explain what he was talking about. And so he was very, in so many respects, artistic
mm-hmm.
In that fashion where mm-hmm. he came out with words that nobody ever used, never thought of using, but Navajo people caught on.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, people back then didn't know how to say or how to illustrate sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
What is the meaning of Indian sovereignty? And he came out with this word. Using the analogy of the rainbow,
uh-huh.
A rainbow, And he says, sovereignty is like a rainbow. And we were created within that rainbow, and the rainbow is something that the Indian people believe it comes from the Great Spirit, and it was not something that was given to us by the coming of the white man or uh-huh. any group of people. Uh-huh. It was always here, and we were born into it. And that's the way he explained rainbow, and it was very powerful.
Yes.
And that was the creation on the part of Raymond Nakai to explain sovereignty to the mm-hmm. Navajo people.
Uh-huh.
And
that's a great example.
Yeah, it's the same thing that Anne Wanika did mm-hmm. when using the Navajo language over the radio about tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
Because tuberculosis, you did not see.
Right,
and you did not really feel
mm-hmm.
The effects of the disease at the time that it's affecting your body. You didn't see it,
mm-hmm.
and so Anna Wanika was the one that comes out with those Navajo words mm-hmm. That says "jeti," meaning it's a disease that could eat into your heart and. Mm-hmm. You're going to have so that your heart is diminished in size and they won't function as well. And so she came out with those kinds of words to make Navajo people mm-hmm. understand. Raymond Nakai was the same
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I remember she reading about how she went around with Scott Preston and convinced him as somebody with traditional ceremonialist and ritual beliefs. And encouraged him to speak to people saying that they weren't being opposed to the religion, but that the tuberculosis had to be fought in a different way, and we had to take advantage of the, you know, some of these other approaches to it. But, you know, I think about her. I remember talking at some length with Carl Todicini a number of years ago now about her role, and as he called her, the pet milk lady, because Pet Milk sponsored her program on the Gallup radio station.
Mm-hmm.
But what, you know, what tremendous strength people like that had. You know, they were so determined to speak, you know, to key issues and make sure the government was doing the right thing. And I can imagine Mrs. Wanika, you know, in front of the council, that all-male congregation, and she was really something. And to have that kind of determination to serve for 30 years or whatever it was, you know, in that capacity, really a determined person, and a person who realized that it would take a long time and hard work to, you know, make things better, but there were things that could become better through that kind of dedication.
Well, I always say that Anna Wanika lived ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm.
She lived ahead of the women's movement in this country. And before people start advocating for women's rights and the role of the women in families and the role of the women in government and all of that, Anna Wanika was way 30, 40, 50 years ahead.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the fact that she was the lone woman mm-hmm. on the Navajo Council for many years,
yes,
is just one of those that that we saw mm-hmm. during our lifetime. What Anna Wanika was all about and what she meant to the Navajo people. I always say this, Peter, where the Navajo people, you have to look at this history. When we were in captivity. And we were marched all the way from Canyon de Chelly to Fort Defiance to Fort Winnegate.
Mm-hmm.
And then all the way into Albuquerque to Santa Fe.
Right.
And then coming back down to Fort Sumner, southeast of Albuquerque in New mm-hmm. Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
There was not one single Navajo leader that took control.
Right.
There was always a group.
Mm-hmm.
And over at Fort Sumner, there was maybe 10, 12, mm-hmm. 15 Navajo leaders mm-hmm. that were just outstanding mm-hmm. as a group, mm-hmm. as a group. And they did their thing together. They planned, and they helped all the other members to survive. And they always managed to do things as a group. Mm-hmm. And the right leading up to the signing of the treaty, the signing of the Navajo and the federal government treaty of 1868. Prior to that, leading up to those days that were signed, when the people were signing that treaty, you know, the Navajo people, those leadership. Mm-hmm. Got together, Chief Manuelito and Ganado Moncho and those mm-hmm. people like that. They did not object to going back to the Navajo land that was suggested to them that went along the state line, uh-huh. Arizona state line, go all the way up to Shiprock, uh-huh. and then coming back down on both sides of that state line. It was a small strip of land, maybe no more than 2 million acres of land, maybe 1.7 million or something like that. It was just a small piece of land that the federal government was willing to make that into a Navajo Nation. They asked the people to go back to that. There were no arguments mm-hmm. among the 10 or 12 leaders that signed the treaty representing the Navajo people. They didn't argue among themselves mm-hmm. and say that land is too small.
Yeah.
What probably happened is that they were so intent on going back to the original Navajo land.
Yes.
Which was different than what the federal government right. was thinking.
Right.
And the federal government can draw those lines. And they can say they want us to go back to this little piece of land here, but, you know, we're so homesick that yeah. we want to get the hell out of there. Yeah.
Well, they fought Sherman who wanted initially to send them to Indian territory, and Barbanzito says, uh-uh.
Yeah. And so they went back to that land, and yeah. when they got back to Fort Defiance area, and they were given each a goat and a sheep, you know, that was their livelihood. Yeah. That was their food.
Right.
And some ration. Some commodity food that was given to them. That was all they needed. And then they used that and they planted some corn mm-hmm. and they planted squash, tomatoes, apples, potatoes, and all of that. You know, they were back in business.
Yeah.
And those leaders probably then had another meeting and say, hey, we didn't want to raise that issue back then, but this land is just too small
right.
for us.
Right.
Why don't we start expanding?
Yeah.
And any kind of arguments that they can think of, good, mm-hmm. Reasonable arguments mm-hmm. that they can think of, they use that to expand mm-hmm. the reservation. And the bottom line for that group of Navajo leaders was the size of the reservation. They wanted to expand. They yeah. wanted to grow. They said that this land wouldn't hold us 10 years, 20 years down. And so our job, number one priority, is to expand mm-hmm. the land. And so they kept on growing,
yeah.
kept on growing
yeah.
until, you know, they came to something like maybe 14, 15 million acres.
Yeah.
And but it didn't stop there.
No.
And the leadership later on, going into the era of Paul Jones and Scott Preston,
right.
and, you know, Jacob Morgan, Howard Gorham, yeah. and Raymond Nakai, all of those people, they kept at it. They kept on adding to the reservation.
Right.
I was just looking at the map the other day, and then looking at the numbers, we now have nearly 17 million acres of land. 17 million acres. That's a huge, huge reservation.
Yep.
So collectively, the Navajo leadership did that.
Yep.
Not only in a period of 1 or 2 years.
No, it's an ongoing.
It was an ongoing thing for 100 years.
Right.
And the last time I saw the Navajo tribal budget, they have something like 53 million that I helped create when I left, called Land Acquisition Fund. We established a Land Acquisition Fund a year before I left the Navajo Nation, and said to the Navajo Nation, to the Navajo people, that we want this trust fund to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And someday we're going to have 20, 30, 40 million in there. And when that happens, any land that's put up for sale adjacent to the Navajo Nation and away from the Navajo Nation, any land put up for sale, that you should be in a position to buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And this trust land acquisition fund will give you that resources to use to buy those land. The last time, about a year and a half ago, when I looked at the tribal budget, it had around 50 million.
Yeah.
And so the collection of the Navajo leaders, they all had that in mind. Mm-hmm. Every one of them that came into office, they said land acquisition is important. But they really didn't have the fund necessary to buy those land. And now, because of what we did during my administration, they're not able to buy those land. And it's grown.
Yeah.
And it may even, as we talk, it may even be over 17 million.
Yeah, you should take great pride in that.
And I would say within the next 20 years, it's going to keep on growing. And so it was a situation where the leadership of the Navajo people through all these years, that was their priorities. Right. That was what they did. Now, there's no other group in America among the Indian people. Yes, they had some great American Indian leaders out there. You know all of them, and you have Sitting Bull out there. You have Chief Joseph. You have Geronimo, and you have all these people. They were good. They were good at the time, but they really didn't do what the Navajo people did. The Navajo people, collectively, their leadership through a long period of time, their priority was to add land.
Yep.
And to this day, they're still doing it. For me, for me, the measurement of what is considered a good American Indian leader for their people, land base should be one of them.
Absolutely.
Because that is so important.
There's so many people who want to make the story of Navajo history or other indigenous peoples primarily a story of victimization and loss. And I always quote to them Darcy McNichol, who said there's a difference between, yes, we have lost many things, he wrote, but we were never defeated. And also, you look to, that's one of the reasons why I enjoyed putting that documents book together, because it really speaks to not only leadership that adds to the land base, but also leadership that protects the land base and doesn't put the people in a position where, you know, it got divided up and allotted and so forth. You have Chi Dodge writing to the Secretary of the Interior, Franklin Lane, in about 1916, and he said, well, you asked me what would happen if we, you know, did allotment on the large Navajo reservation, And I'm writing to tell you, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do it. It will serve us. It will not serve us well. We need to, because that's the heart of our country, and that's what we need to defend, and it's the foundation, essentially, he says, that we're building from.
Mm-hmm.
And so the fact that, while there was some allotment of, you know, in the checkerboard area and things like that, that the main section of the reservation, the heart of the reservation, the large portions added by executive order, that Chi Dodge and people who followed saw it as their, you know, one of their most important responsibilities is to make sure that that remained land held in trust and wasn't divided up into all these individually held parcels, which just, as you well know, has played havoc with economic and social, cultural issues on so many other reservations. So I think, you know, when you think about history as being something not just that happens to you, but that you make, you know, that Navajo leadership over time understood that and acted upon it. And that's, and you know, that's a, if there's one thing we need to do more of, I would argue, not only in Navajo history, but in American Indian history generally, is we need to recognize the kind of fight that the Navajos and others made to forge a future that would be, you know, viable. And, you know, it's as you were saying, it's a very important dimension of, and it's a sort of legacy of that leadership.
Well, I think it's because of those kinds of attitudes and among the leadership of the Navajo people that way back in mid-1930s, when there was also a movement to divide up mm-hmm. the land and make land so that it allotted to individuals mm-hmm. and individual families, Navajo people found out what that did to their landholdings.
Mm-hmm.
And when the Navajo people started selling that those allotted land to the non-Indians, they put a stop to it.
Uh-huh.
And because historically it was getting into whatever it is that they were trying to do, rather than expanding the land base of the Navajo people, by having this allotment
right.
on the Navajo, when the Navajo people were beginning to sell some of their land,
sure.
they said, hey, that's not what we're all about. That's not something that you should be doing. Mm-hmm. Instead, we should be adding more land. And they put a stop to it. So mm-hmm. they acted.
Yes.
They acted when they had to act.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, those decisions were hard by the tribal government, but they did, for me, mm-hmm. they did what was necessary,
yes.
which was to act opposing any kind of diminishing the landholding of the Navajo people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's one good example of the quality right. leadership that Navajo exhibited through all these years. The other one that I think is also very, very important is one that you and I are in, which is in education.
Mm-hmm.
Way back in the late 1870, 1880, when Chief Manuelito became such a powerful figure on the mm-hmm. Navajo Nation.
Mm-hmm.
The Navajo people didn't want to send their children to school.
Right.
They practically refused to send their children to school. And I could hear many of the older people saying, I don't want to send my children to school because look what the white people did to us. and I don't want to subject my children to that kind of education where they would become somebody like them. And the Navajo people were just very upset about what was happening to them, and they weren't about to send their children to school.
Sure.
And Chief Manuelito then came into being, and he says to the Navajo people, hey, look, there are so many non-Navajos out there, non-Indians,
mm-hmm.
And Chief Manuelito says that I took a trip to Washington, D.C., and along the way I saw so many white people, and they have farms, they have food, they have big tractors, they have bulldozers, and they're plowing their land, and they're raising so much food. They have cars, they have grocery stores, and they even have a vehicle that flies in the air.
That's right.
And so he says that these guys aren't going to leave.
Right.
They're going to keep on fighting us. And he says that I can't believe the number of non-Indian people that's out there. And he was explaining this at a sweat lodge, along with other Navajo leaders that were taking a sweat bath. And he picked up a sand. He picked up a sand in two hands, and it was breezy that day.
Mm-hmm.
And he let the sand go, and it flew. The sand blew. And he says, if you were to count all the sand, the little pieces of sand in here, that's how many there are out there, plus maybe 20, 30, 100 times over. That's how many non-Indian, non-Navajo people are out there. So put your bow and arrows down. Don't fight. There's just too many. And he says that the best thing we could do is to send our children to school. And when we do that, we'll fight them with education.
Right.
We will turn our own children into being lawyers, being doctors, being engineers, being nurses. All of those kinds of education and schooling will have our students become that. And then we'll fight them with that.
Right.
We're not going to use gun.
Right.
We're not going to use bullets. We're not going to use bow and arrow. We're going to use education. That's how we'll fight them.
Yeah.
That's the day when he said, education. My children, education is the ladder. Go tell our people to take it, he says. And that's what he meant. And so education was very unpopular among the Navajo people up to that point. And he was one of the leaders that came forth and said, I disagree with all of you. We need to send our children to school. And he said it at a time when it was very unpopular to say that. Very unpopular for anybody on the Navajo Nation to say that. And here we are, over 100 years later.
Right.
Look at the number of Navajo children that are in colleges and universities across, across America. I just talked with Rose Graham last week, who was here, and she was saying that there are 10,000, over 10,000 Navajo children in school, at colleges and universities throughout America.
Really? Wow, that's very impressive.
And she says the Navajo Nation doesn't fund all of them.
No, can't.
We only fund a very, very small proportion of that. And she says that most of these kids have earned their own scholarship. They use other resources to go to school. They're beginning to be very resourceful. And they don't heavily rely on the Navajo Nation government all that much anymore, she says. So when you see that many Navajo children in school, you know, that's very encouraging. Encouraging for me. And just look at ASU. You were talking about some of the accomplishments. Look what happened last year.
Right.
In the year 2008, May of 2008, we graduated a record number of American Indian students here.
Yes.
we graduated over 300 Native American students. To be exact, I believe it was 305. And out of that 305 graduating class, something like 75% of them are Navajo people.
Yes.
And when you look at the 305 graduates, 21 of them were doctorate.
That's very impressive.
21 doctorate.
That's very impressive.
That's how many degrees we gave out. And then 56 was people with master's degree.
That's very impressive.
So when you look at those numbers, 300 some odd students, 21 doctorate,
mm-hmm.
56 with a master's degree, they're all out there.
Yeah.
And it looks like this year, 2009,
yes,
it's going to be a repeat.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's going to be a repeat. And that, for me, that's effect of the leadership of Chief Manuelito.
Right.
And that's more than what money can buy.
That's right. Absolutely.
And I guess that's why, for me, I agree that we have all this land, we have mm-hmm. all this resource. Mm-hmm. Yes, we have lots of problems on the Navajo Nation. People are talking about tribal government reform. People mm-hmm. are talking about the horror stories of education on the Navajo. Sure. There's just a lot of problems. But if we have all that space
mm-hmm.
with its natural resources,
yes,
and then if we can educate more and more Navajo, what more can you ask for?
Mm-hmm.
What more can you ask for? That's all we need is those educated mm-hmm. the Navajo students to go back someday.
Right.
Someday they're going to all get together out here.
Yes.
And they're going to say, hey, let's make a commitment to return.
Yes.
And let's develop the Navajo Nation this way.
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to all go back.
Mm-hmm.
When that day that happens, we're going to see the real, real yes. progress of the Navajo Nation that's meaningful,
mm-hmm.
that comes from within,
mm-hmm.
rather than having that movement come from the outside.
Imposed from the outside. Yeah,
yeah, that's genuine progress mm-hmm. that Navajo mm-hmm. people could have.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess you and I spent so much time in educating the Indian youth here at Arizona State University, because we see that's happening.
Yes.
And every year we're getting closer and closer to that.
Right.
For me, that's exciting. That's exciting.
Absolutely.
And I guess that's why I'm continuing to work here.
I'm glad.
As long as I have energy,
I'm
going to remain here and do those kinds of things. And I think we're beginning to see the light of a real progress for the Navajo Nation.
Absolutely. I'm really pleased to hear you articulate this in this way, and you think about it. It's such an opposite from how Navajos were perceived and other Native groups were perceived 100 years ago when they were talking about the vanishing Indian, the end of the trail, and so forth and so on. And, you know, I've argued that not only are there more Navajos today than there were 100 years ago when they were taking those photographs, but probably there are more Navajos today than there were Indians 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of scale and a kind of size and a kind of appropriate ambition and determination that fuels the future. And I like that public service announcement a few years ago that Fort McDowell put out, and they said, "Our future is burning bright."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's right. And you see that in many different parts of Indian country, but I think nowhere is the fire brighter than it is within the Navajo Nation.
Good. Well, you know, Pete, my son picks me up.
Yeah.
We share a ride, so
that's good.
I have to get back over to the office before four.
Well, I think
because he just works several blocks from here, and then he gets off at four, and then he comes over and picks me up.
Good. Well, think about when you'd like to do this. Extra little bit, yeah. It doesn't have to be long, but I just think, and I don't want it to be, I don't want to have it anything that you don't want to have in there, but I just know that that's the one dimension that there'll be an expectation that you'll speak to that in some way, and you don't have to do so negatively or you know, in a way that's inappropriate. But I think that would be good. So, I think you can check with Janie. I guess look at your schedule and let me know when you'd like to do that.
Okay, I agree. We can't. It's something that we can't skip. But
no,
we have,
I don't
I
think
have
so.
To say it. Yeah.
You covered lots of ground today. I thought it was very good. I'm very pleased with our conversation today, and
we
can have one more.
I think that
really will do it. I'm going to this Western History Association meeting. You remember the one we had in Scottsdale a few years ago, and this will be in Salt Lake this time. And I will leave a week from, a week from tomorrow. So if there's any chance we could do it prior to that, that would be nice. If we can't, then we'll just do it when I get back.
Yeah.
So you take a look at your calendar and you can block out an hour or so somewhere. I'd be happy to meet
with you. So next week, like the 20th, you'll be up there, huh?
No, I won't leave till the 22nd.
22nd, okay.
Yeah. I think Monday is the 20th, isn't it? And Wednesday is the 22nd, yeah.
It has to be after that.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, the 20th is Navajo Nation Council meeting.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to be up there for one day. Then the National Congress American Indian meeting is down here. So.
Okay, well, there we are. Yeah. Well, then maybe you two can look in the calendar for the week that starts Monday the 27th. Maybe we can do it that week sometime. You see. You know, it doesn't.
Okay.
We're almost there.
All right.
And when we meet next time, what I'll do is I'll bring in, you know, sort of putting some of these together. If we have the, we really need the TypeScript from today's session. But I think it's covering lots of ground, and I think it's going to be a terrific book.
Okay.
And I have your approval to talk to UNM Press at that conference, not to make any decision, but just to let them know where we are on this, if that's okay with you.
Okay.
Okay. Good.
All right.
Good.
Okay. We'll see you, Peter.
Okay, thanks.
You take care of take care of yourself,
I will.
My friend.
Yeah. I will. You too.
Yep. I gotta call my son and
say. Yeah, here we are.
Yeah.
I hope I haven't kept you too long.
No, it's okay.
Thank you.
It was good.
Okay. Good deal. Thank you.
Yep.
I just want to make sure he gets turned off properly and all the rest, hoping that we didn't do anything to.
Great. It looks like you got it all there. Over an hour.